Our next speaker is Dr. Robert O'Brien from Super R&D Laboratories. Dr. O'Brien is the founder and CEO of Super Research and Development, an analytical service and contract research firm in Kelowna.
Yes,
okay, thank you. Dr. O'Brien has been involved in a senior executive in a variety of companies in the cannabis and natural health product sector. He's also founded a series of successful commercial analytical laboratories. And prior to engaging in the private sector, Dr. O'Brien held research and academic positions at where he specialized in analytical mass spectroscopy. He's obtained his PhD from Compton University under the supervision of K.W. Michael
Sue,
and Roger Gourmand. At the Natural Research Council. He's currently an adjunct professor at both Thompson River University and UBC.
Thank you very much.
I'm not going to even try to pronounce that again.
Okay, perfect. I was
welcome, Rob.
If I knew you were reading out loud, I would have put a few spicier things in there.
So, you can unmute yourself.
All right, so where are we at with the presentation here? We're going to do it.
Yes. Just put down.
So is this the PowerPoint or is this the PDF?
Yes,
okay, perfect. Brilliant. All right, so prior to last year's AOAC meeting, I came into the meeting with the feeling that the methods that were relevant, particularly for contaminants, for vaping products, weren't fit for purpose. At that meeting is when we first had these hit of people getting sick and dying from use of vaporizers. And we had tragic pictures of young people in ER situations. And at that point, I stood up, as I do, and started pushing for some approaches where we looked at these things a little bit differently. And so listed in this program is that we have the perspective of a contract lab in Canada. It's not really that perspective. It's more the perspective of scientists who sees a problem that they have the skill set to potentially address. So Super Research and Development, we use the tagline that we're a quality solution provider. We do provide analytical services, both for the, in the US we call dietary supplement, Canada we call natural health products, and the cannabis sector. But we help companies with their processing, sourcing materials, reference materials, validation kits, as well as providing training and education. We're a private contract research organization, but both myself and my colleague, Matthew Rosenden, are adjunct professors at local universities. So just to make sure they're all on the same page here, we do have a conflict declaration. We do work with companies that are producing vape products to help them determine safety and other things relating to that. And we're an applicant and a consultant on a variety of Health Canada cannabis license applications, testing, research, and processing. And we're also heavily engaged, or have been heavily engaged with ASTM and the CAS program. So let's just take a step back and ask this very fundamental question that we all know the answer to. Why do we test for contaminants? We test to ensure that consumers are not exposed to dangerous chemical agents when they use those products as intended. If they decide to eat the Tide Pods, we can't help it. However, when used as intended, high temperature vaporization devices deliver a series of chemical agents that are chemically different from what you put in the device. And this can be due to chemical rearrangements, oxidation, and even pyrolysis, depending on the temperature. And so the chemical agents that the consumer is exposed to is dependent on a number of things. Formulations, vaporization temperature being the main factors. So ingredients and formulations must be evaluated at what happens at these vaporization if we're going to ensure safety with these products. But if we don't, be quite sure. We are doing testing. The testing just seems to be uncontrolled human trials with hospitalization and deaths as the metric. Pretty harsh little statement, but that's kind of what we're doing, right? And let me show you what this data looks like. This is the picture set that I mentioned that disturbed me. And the CDC has done fantastic work gathering information on this. And we're looking at approximately 2,800 individuals who have been hospitalized from the vaping. 64 deaths from this. And this is what the data looks like. And for you in the audience who are analytical chemists, this almost looks like a Gaussian distribution. This looks like a peak on a baseline. I want you to take a look at a couple things there. One is that prior to March, we didn't really see a lot of hospitalizations due to this. And I also want to make sure you remember that e-cigarettes have been in the North American marketplace and Western Europe since about 2008. Now, a little bit of an inconvenient truth for those people who just want to say, let's get rid of all these vaporizers, is if you overlay, if you look at the number of deaths from cigarette-relating diseases, it's about 400,000 a year in North America. And this has been dropping steadily since around 2008. And if you look at those countries where the biggest drop in percent people dying from those diseases, the biggest drop has been in countries that have introduced e-cigarettes. We won't get into that. So what was causing these deaths? It seems to be, when we look at the metadata, and that the culprit has been identified pretty closely as vitamin E acetate. And the people looking at these things have really wanted to also see some either ammonia, lipid-based ammonia, and other things, but they haven't really found that. When we look at the autopsy reports and the pathology that they see there, what they really see, beyond a lot of medical terms here, is reactions that are consistent with noxious chemical fumes. And this, it also suggests a similar type of injury. The inconvenient piece of that is that if you take vitamin E acetate and you put it on tissues, it doesn't cause responses like noxious chemical fumes. So I just want you to take a second and step back in your mind and imagine that you're a producer of a company that's making this type of product. And imagine that you really want to make a quality product and you have the best interest in mind. Vitamin E acetate, it's a vitamin. It's not considered something that is hazardous. It's not a flavoring compound, so if you ban flavoring compounds, you wouldn't get this. In terms of ingestion, it's safe, of course. And there's no testing or standard that would indicate that if you used it in the vaporizer, there'd be any problem whatsoever. So in some ways, these producers, quote unquote, innocently made products that they didn't see any reason would cause this problem. And yet, 64 people died. And a lot of those people were young people in their 20s. I cannot imagine a more tragic outcome for somebody that just wants to use a product and then we have young people die from this. So, I know, and I'm sorry, I was in the wrong room, so I missed the previous speaker's talk, but so we took a little different take on this. The technique that we're using to figure some of these things out is Headspace GCMS. And what this is, for those people who don't have a background, is you take a vial and you put a liquid or solid in the vial and you seal it, and then the gas phase above this is what we call the headspace. This gas phase is above the liquid or solid. And we can increase the amount of volatiles in there by simply heating it up. And then we can take a sample of this gas sample in a syringe. And in our workflow, all of this process piece occurs in a specific autosampler type. Once that gas sample, then we inject it onto a gas chromatograph where we separate out in time the individual chemical components, and we detect this with a mass spectrometer. And the data set we get looks something like this, where this is a time-based profile, and each peak represents a different chemical that comes out. And because we have a mass spectrometer there, we can identify what these things are. This is the system that we have in place at our facility. And let's then take a look at this again. You can see that in many ways, this type of approach does look like a controlled example of what you would have with a different type of vaporizer, but you have complete control of how long, what temperature. There's some exact controls here. So it's an interesting surrogate, if you like, but it's really just a way to control and look at what we're producing. We've come up with this idea, this terminology called vaporization potential. And what this is simply the potential for what's vaporized at different temperatures. We use this VP with a number to indicate what temperature. And then we can look at what toxic compounds are produced at these temperatures. And we can then set criteria for unacceptable and unacceptable toxins. And we can look at the thermal degradation products. And just as a point ahead, many of these are residual solvents. Now, when we look at vitamin E acetate, now remember, what we're trying to do with this is we want to understand what an individual component, potential ingredient, or mixture will produce at different temperatures. So in this one, you can see that's the peak at the end there for vitamin E acetate. And at a low temperature of 180, we basically just see vitamin E acetate. As we increase the temperature, we of course get more vitamin E acetate into the gas phase. And then at 240, we begin to see some degradation products out of these small peaks here. At 270, we get quite a few degradation products. And at 300, we get quite a suite of degradation products. And the previous question talked about, well, ISO and that, they have sampling techniques that draw from different devices, and there's been some fantastic work done. But what they haven't done is they haven't identified a compound like vitamin E acetate as a problem. They haven't been able to identify what should be in solutions and what shouldn't be in solutions. And so that's one of the problems. However, if we want to understand what these individuals who use these vaporization products that contain vitamin E, what they were exposed to, this is the type of data that we'll use. And we start looking at what these things are and finding the match, and we see some very interesting things. We see a lot of small organic acids. And these have these strange peaks here that are sort of fronting. That's what an acid tends to do in this phase. And we can identify all of these things. But the task of trying to correlate this to a toxicity in a way that you could rule out a formulation or an ingredient, it's too much work to do. It's too much to do on your own. So, if you know, we can use this to understand what agents are delivered to the user, and that's chemical profile is very useful for that. But remember, the chemical profile is going to be very dependent on the temperature. So of all these people that died from using these products, I don't believe they asked the question, what temperature was your vaporizer being run at? So that's metadata that's really important. And how can we find a screening method that would prevent the next vitamin E acetate from happening? The next set of people from dying. We don't want to use human trials as a way to determine what's toxic in these. And even the calibration of these things are kind of difficult. So let's say I'm running at 300, and I want to do a calibration curve, and let's see what, I want to look at the hexane. Well, when I put hexane in above 280, it degrades to benzene. And I want you to think about fit-for-purpose testing, where we do residual solvents. And a product passes for residual solvents with hexane in it, and it's quite a high concentration. But then when they use the product, they're actually converting that hexane to benzene. So is that contaminant test fit for purpose for that product type? Just as a thought. So we came up with a different approach. Rather than try to reinvent the wheel, we already have residual solvent acceptable limits. So we then decided to take a little bit of a different approach. We would heat the material up to a certain temperature, a VP potential, hold for 5 minutes, then cool it down. Take that resulting material and then run it through the residual solvent criteria and see if it passes or fails. And then we also picked not quite arbitrarily, but somewhat, 240 degrees Celsius as a threshold, because that's kind of an upper limit for some of these devices. And what we found, if you go to 300, you're going to produce nasties no matter what you do. So this, again, is vitamin E acetate again. And this is through this other approach. So this has been heat. This was just the ambient sample. And then we run it through our headspace analysis, which is right at 95 degrees. And the peaks at the front here, this is just air. So we're collecting data from the very go. So we see these small things like cyanide, now we can see other things, but this is just air. So ignore this, but there's nothing there with vitamin E acetate. As we get to 180, we see nothing. 240, we begin to see a series of different compounds. And by 300, we see a whole mess of compounds. And these, again, include these small acids, a lot of ketones and related compounds that are oxidation products. But we can then use these and forget about these limits. Let's take a look at, we're just going to use the acceptable residual solvent. And you can see here that this is the USP limit. And you see when it hits 240, we're failing for acetic acid. Right? 5,778 part per million equivalents. And you can see at 300, you're even getting a bit of benzene. So if we had this in place, we could have said, no, don't use vitamin E acetate as an ingredient because it breaks down to something dangerous at 240. But the proof is in the pigeon. The proof in the pigeon. You didn't know the proof was in the pigeon. You were looking in this pudding, which we don't really know where it's at. But it could be, right? There's enough. You could think, you know, maybe that's a. Anyway, I don't. Rabbit hole. Stay out of the rabbit hole. We worked with some producers of products, and we had one that approached us and said, "Hey, we're thinking about using a product that's 80% phytol." Now, phytol is a terpenoid compound that is naturally in some of these products, but usually at very low levels. And they were looking at using it in a vaporization product that they're going to sell in the marketplace. And so we started looking at it. And you can see, even at 180, you're starting to get some breakdown products. And at 240 and 300, you're getting nasty things produced that are far worse than what we saw with vitamin E acetate. So we recommended to them, do not, under any circumstance, produce a product that has this, or phytol would be the other next little observed comp on our hospitalization and death stress. And if we start looking at the compounds, we see the range of some of the similar ones, but also benzene, which is this peak here, is quite significant. In fact, when we do the comparison here, this would fail as low as 210 Celsius, and we begin to see benzene at 270 and 300 degrees. But it fails for a lot of compounds, including formic acid and acetic acid at 240. Now, think about what this will do to you if you use this as a product. These organic acids, they would cause nauseous chemical burns in your lung tissue. And you can look at a toxicity for a solvent that you pour in your hand, or then you could burn your hand and look at the same toxicity. It's going to be worse. Same thing's happening in the lungs. We've also used this for other mixtures. This is a certain flavoring agent, but a client sent us. This is in MCT oil, which I don't recommend for any vaporization product, by the way. But we took it through our process, and you see that it's pretty reasonable up to 300. Another formulation with just a different flavor was failing our test at 240. So it just allows us a way to say, should you use this ingredient? Should you not? It's not really all the things that are going to be delivered, but it's a way for producers to screen products to say, at least let's throw these ones out. Let's not use these in these products. So this vaporization potential, which you would actually use to get what's actually delivered, and the equivalent residual solvent analysis, which you'd use to screen and dump products, seems to work. I'm also working with ASTM, as I told you. We should have a standard for this as a test screening for ingredients within the next 6 months. And I would always suggest clients to say, don't use this product above 240 and maybe even a little lower. In fact, at 300, most things go to hell in a handbasket. Did I get that one right? No pigeons there. Now, the AOAC is proposing a heated inhalated science program, and I think this is very important. Again, if you want to understand what the consumer is exposed to, you need to know what happens at these temperatures. And we're also going to coordinate this with ISO initiatives as well. So, and then the other one, just as a laugh and a giggle, we're also going to suggest to people, if you're going to be cool, don't use it above 420. 420 just happens to be 250 degrees Celsius, and a lot of the problems happen after that. So it's sort of a safety thing that may work for public education. And I also want you to think a little bit about, we've actually just published a method where we looked at terpenes, nicotine, cannabinoids at 180, and we got good quantitative results. So we see mostly just the terpenes in that transfer to that temperature, so that temperature works. But that's around 350, just a little bit over 350 Celsius. This is a temperature that you cook in your oven, you're familiar with. But at these higher temperatures, these are temperatures above 500 Celsius when you're above 300. So that's the temperature you set your oven at to char everything in there. Not a smart temperature to use, but making these connections for users to have more common sense thing is useful. This is my team. And if there's any questions, I'll be happy to take them.